GW's Rod Hill for
Afternoon. Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I got a couple of them from both north and south of the Columbia River. Number one, lame duck governor, climate carbon Jay Inslee, now says apparently he thinks it's okay to violate environmental regulations if it's necessary to save the environment from global warming. I'll get into the details of that one in just a moment, but I want to tell you as well about the U.S. Postal Service, which is now screwing over its American customers and doing so deliberately in the name of efficiency. They even interfered with Oregon's primary election by artificially delaying the delivery of mailed ballots without any legal authority whatsoever. And you know what? This is a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. On this issue, I'm actually forced to agree with Democrat New York U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. I know. It's one of those red letter days. You know that at least once or twice a year, I'll be forced to agree with the senior senator from the great state of New York. Now, Ron actually claims he represents Oregon. He doesn't represent Oregon. He lives in New York. His family lives in New York. His two small children are in New York. His wife is registered to vote in New York. But Ron Wyden still pretends to be from the Pacific Northwest. Let me get into the details of that in a moment. First, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you to the head of the line. Maybe you disagree with Wyden. I imagine I'll get some calls from letter carriers, but let me tell you this. I have no beef with the people who carry the mail. I have a giant beef with the people who actually run the system. So understand the difference there. I can fault the system without actually faulting the people who simply put on the USPS uniform and go out to deliver the mail. I don't have any beef with you. If I do, believe me, I'll let you know. But this is amazing. Earlier this week, Senator Ron Wyden, as we said, pretend senator from Oregon, and Medford Mayor Randy Sparacino, and we tried to get Mayor Sparacino on. He's got meetings all day long, so he's unavailable. But they are calling on the U.S. Postal Service to change what sounds like one of the most cockamamie systems you've ever heard of, where literally they're going to take all of the outgoing mail, no matter where it's coming from in the state. So think about, say, a letter coming from a town I lived in for a couple of years when I was a kid, Klamath Falls, about a 5-hour drive from Portland. And if that letter is going from, say, Klamath Falls to Keno or to Medford or to Central Point or Jacksonville in southern Oregon, it travels all the way to Portland, where it is sorted and processed, and then travels all the way back to southern Oregon. Now, if somebody thinks that's an efficient system, you probably understand at this point why the U.S. Postal Service, which is a government agency, but it is an independent government agency. By that, they mean they set their own rules and they decide whether or not they're going to be able to make their budget. The U.S. Postal Service routinely loses billions of dollars. And in all the years since 1973, when they were made an independent but still government agency, and when they promised, cross their hearts and hope to die, that they would always pay all of their bills, they've never broken even. And I know the people who work for the Postal Service say, well, it's not our fault. They say, well, then you shouldn't have made the promise. You promised Congress, let us be independent. We'll make our own decisions. Now, there are other companies that deliver things like UPS, like Federal Express, like all of the other postal or package services, but they're not allowed to do first-class mail. No, that is owned lock, stock, and barrel. The law says you're not even allowed to compete with the U.S. Postal Service when it comes to first-class mail. So what do they do with first-class mail? Well, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has said that at least 20 facilities are going to be included in a pause on consolidation, including Oregon. But they don't want to change these things. What they've done is they've said, we're going to consolidate all the sorting. If we put all the sorting in Portland, then we just take the mail from everywhere else in the state, even if it's just going across the street. In fact, Mayor Sparacino, the guy I'd like to talk to from Medford, gave a local builder as an example. He said the builder mailed a bill across the city of Medford, which I think you can drive across in about 5 minutes, might take you 7 minutes to drive across the whole town. The letter took longer to go across town than a letter the man got from the East Coast of the United States. It's that bad. And then I'll point out to you that a couple of weeks ago, while the election was still pending, because now elections are not on election day, they're actually 3 or 4 weeks of elections, they literally, USPS did, without any legal authority whatsoever, decided to deliberately delay the delivery of ballots. This is how crazy it is. Jeremy Schilling, who's president of the local postal workers union, they won't talk to me either, although they're invited on the show. And I'd be glad to have USPS on. Every time we call them, we get ghosted by USPS. They won't answer questions. So to heck with them. Postal management chose to disregard the instructions of the Secretary of State by loading ballots into private vehicles and dropping them in county elections boxes after hours. Oh, now they deliver the mail under the cover of darkness so that nobody can see what they're doing. Schilling says he found one example of a ballot that was headed to the Klamath County Clerk's office, postmarked in Portland on election day, didn't arrive in Medford until the 28th of May, 2 days ago. Now, that's crazy. And that's election interference. So, in this case, Ron Wyden is saying, you've got to put this thing on hold. It doesn't make any sense. Now, let me get to Jay Inslee. Carbon Jay, as we call him, because he came up with that crazy carbon tax that's costing everybody in the Evergreen State an extra 50 cents a gallon when they buy a gallon of gasoline because of the carbon tax. And if you ask me, Lars, where can I see the carbon tax? Is it on the pump? Is it on a sign? No, in fact, you're not allowed to put it on a sign. But get this. Climate Jay Inslee has a weird idea about regulations. He apparently likes environmental regulations, but then you've got this wind farm and solar project that they're proposing just south of the Tri-Cities in Washington State. They were supposed to start construction 3 years ago, and they are still in the planning phase. They haven't turned dirt on it yet. And Governor Inslee has sent the latest site certification agreement back to the Energy Facility Siting Council. What does that mean? It means that all these people who tell us, don't worry about us closing down coal-fired power and making power generated from natural gas literally illegal in both states. No, we're gonna take care of this with wind and solar. Well, consider this. It's called the Horse Heaven Clean Energy Center, and it was supposed to start construction 3 years ago. I mean, don't throw out your coal-fired power plants just yet. If they get this thing up and running, it's going to have 800 megawatts of solar panels. It's going to have 1,100 megawatts of energy from wind with 231 wind turbines. It's right now scheduled to sit on 72,000 acres, more than 100 square miles of land. And Jay Inslee says it's too small. And he says sometimes those environmental regulations take an overly broad approach to addressing a very different type of impact. In other words, throw out the environmental regulations if Jay Inslee says it's necessary to save the environment. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. Your body well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, who knew it that you could run a major courtroom trial like the game of Clue? By major, I mean the criminal trial of a former president, now a candidate for office, clearly intended to affect the outcome of a presidential election this year. We absolutely knew the fix was in when New York's court system, which is required to assign judges to criminal cases randomly, managed out of 28 available judges to pick Democrat donor Juan Merchan as the judge over and over and over again. Merchan, whose daughter makes a six-figure salary raising millions of dollars for top name-brand Democrats, now oversees his third Trump-related trial. Random my fat backside. Now Judge Merchan tells the 12 jurors who are deliberating right now, they don't have to unanimously decide which crime Donald Trump committed, only that the 12 agree that he committed some crime. In about 100 criminal trials I've covered over the years, I've never heard a judge give that direction. And none of the lawyers I've asked this week about it have either. In the game of Clue, you can tag Colonel Mustard in the library with a pistol, or in the kitchen with a steak knife, or in the garden with a lead pipe, as long as it's Colonel Mustard. Judge Merchan tells the jurors, just get 12 of you to decide that the evil orange man is guilty of some kind of crime, and we're good to go. You want to live in an America with that kind of justice system? And our first question of the day, and a gentleman sent a picture, and it was a very good, actually several pictures, of very expensive and extensive copper plate used in what he tells me is a Portland public school project. And he wrote, Lars, chatting with my fellow HVAC pros around the country on Facebook today, I saw this post from Portland about the school buildings. A lot of items unnecessarily made from copper. That stuff costs three times as much as standard factory painted or paintable outdoor metal. It's purely decorative and mostly meant for things like luxury homes. I wonder where the public money falls into the black hole. And by the way, I held his name back. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the city of New York because today the Supreme Court decided, get this, unanimously, all nine justices, the six conservative originalists, and of course the three loony liberals on the court, all nine of them agreed that the NRA can sue a former New York official for doing this. They encouraged private companies to break their ties with the NRA. The Supreme Court ruled that the National Rifle Association can now sue a former New York State official over her efforts to encourage companies to end their ties with the gun rights group, saying her actions would constitute unlawful coercion. And as Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who's one of the most liberal justices on the Supreme Court, said, government officials cannot attempt to coerce private parties in order to punish or suppress views that the government disfavors. And that's what Sonia Sotomayor wrote. It's not that often that you get the liberals on the court agreeing with the conservatives. In this case, I think they're exactly right. Today's best email of the day so far, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Window Nation semi-annual sale. Now on with 50% off on all windows, no interest 5 years, and bonus savings. Call 866-90-NATION or WindowNation.com. George Tunsell writes in from Enumclaw. Hey, Lars, how's this for a conspiracy for Conspiracy Theory Thursday? Trump is found guilty on one or more counts. Judge Merchan has him handcuffed and sent to Rikers Island awaiting sentencing. Sentencing comes after November 5th, the election this year. I'm sure glad the Democrats are saving our democracy. Keep up the good work, signed George in Enumclaw. And then I got this note, and I have to throw this one in as well. This one came from Andrew. Lars, we saw it during the Trump-Hillary matchup. Trump was packing stadiums while Hillary's events were tiny by comparison. Believe me, I remember those days. Hillary couldn't fill a church in one case. Now we have Biden supporters masquerading as journalists, commenting on the tremendous size of Joe Biden's events. One of the latest was attended mainly by journalists. I suspect they were all there for the free food, or at least the cackling one made inane comments. Kind of like the unlikable child with a pork chop tied around his neck so the family dog will give him some attention, and the rent of a mob astroturfing as sign-wielding supporters was the very definition of enthusiasm. They looked about as energetic as the big guy. Night of the Living Dead, to be sure. I wonder how many voting districts will have more votes than registered voters this time. Biden will need all those extras if there is to be a sequel to this very bad movie. Signed, Andrew. I want to tell you something, too. There were some real reporters who showed up at Joe's most recent event, the one that was held in a high school gymnasium. I mean, it was a good-sized gymnasium. It wasn't like the old-school gymnasiums like Tillamook High School, where the wall was about 6 inches from the lines on the basketball court. No, this was a good-sized gymnasium, but not necessarily like, you know, the pros would play in it, just a good-sized gymnasium. And what did the Biden crew do? They knew that they were not going to draw a lot of people. And this was in a fairly sizable community. I think it might have been Philadelphia. In any case, what they did is, if you've ever been to the Modus Center, and I'm sure that Tacoma Dome has a similar arrangement and some of the other venues in Seattle. But at the Moda in Portland, if they decide you have an event that's not going to draw that many people, say 3,000 or 4,000 people, they do what's called Theater of the Clouds. They put a giant black curtain about 2/3 of the way down the arena, and they leave the last third for your event. And you end up with this half bowl of seats and then room for a stage and all the rest of that. So a place like Moda that will seat 20,000 for a basketball game is now seating, say, 3,000 to 5,000. They did the very same thing in that high school gymnasium. They put up barricades ahead of time because it appears the Biden crew knew that the boss was not going to draw a gigantic crowd. So what they did was they put up a bunch of barricades. They set up a huge number of tables and workspaces for all the reporters covering Joe. And then they crammed the few people who actually showed up for Joe's rally. They crammed them into about 1/4 to 1/3 of one end of a high school gymnasium, if that draws a picture for you. And then when the reporters from all the legacy media showed up, they shot pictures, and it looked like Joe was in this massive crowd of people. The problem was, it was a massive crowd that couldn't even fill a high school gymnasium. As you know, when Donald Trump showed up in what's known as Arctic Blue, New Jersey, and he showed up at Wildwood, he drew a crowd of between 80 and 100,000. And when he showed up even in Democrat-dominated the Bronx, part of New York, he drew 25,000 people to an event like that. Joe Biden would have a tough time drawing 250 people. And you understand, they know what those images do to Americans. Americans look at a guy like Joe Biden running for re-election. They know he's in the dumps in the polls. They know that his approval ratings are rock bottom. And then he shows up for an event in a good-sized town, and he can't even draw a crowd? You're right. Hillary Clinton had the same kind of problem. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Always glad to get your phone calls and emails. And coming up in a moment, we've got to talk about the war on farmers in the Northwest. I'll get to your phone calls and emails on the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
We can save lives.
He does the work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Couple of things I want to mention to you. Three Bobs Ferguson. You know, Three Bobs Ferguson, currently attorney general, wannabe for governor. And we call him Three Bobs because two other Bob Fergusons filed against him. And then, of course, he bullied them into dropping out of the race because he said, you can't have three Bob Fergusons on the ballot. Well, it turned out he did some other things as well. And now another gubernatorial hopeful, and that's State Senator Mark Mullett. You've heard him on the program. He has filed two ethics complaints against now attorney general Bob Ferguson. He filed them yesterday. He filed them with the Washington Bar Association and the State Ethics Board. And here's what he's saying that Ferguson did. Ferguson, as Attorney General, leaned on the Secretary of State, Steve Hobbs. And why did he do that? Here's the way it's described in the complaint. A.G. Ferguson applied verbal pressure on Secretary of State Steve Hobbs to violate RCW 29A and rearrange the ballot order, as the Ferguson campaign legal team had already demanded in a memo earlier that day. They were asking that Bob Ferguson demanded that the Secretary of State's office, if there were going to be three Bob Fergusons on the ballot, make his the first Bob Ferguson name on the ballot. Throwing his weight around like that gets an ethics complaint. I'm sure the, I don't know if they'll take meaningful action against Ferguson, but Ferguson is a slimy character. He certainly doesn't deserve to be the governor of the state of Washington. Let's go to Tom. Hey, Tom, thanks for listening. Glad to get your call. What's on your mind today on this Conspiracy Theory Thursday?
The conspiracy is the U.S. Postal Service.
Huh. Yeah.
Plain and simple. they are the worst-run organization on the face of the planet.
Maybe they're not as bad as DMV, but they come close.
No, actually, I would say DMV is a little bit better.
You think so? Okay.
And the inefficiencies, the attitudes of the postal workers, not all, but the vast majority of, I live in western Washington County here in Oregon.
Yeah.
I don't want to say my specific city.
That's all right.
You can see, but because if I do, I'll probably get reprisal.
Your mail will end up. But see, Tom, I've never really had a bad experience with the individual workers. So I don't have a dog in the fight. I don't have any family members who work for USPS. But I agree with you that the organization is badly run. But I've never had a bad experience with the workers themselves. Tom,
they're terrible. They move stuff that they don't care.
You know what, Tom, I got to tell you, your phone's breaking up. We'll try to get you on a cleaner line. Let me go to Tim. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Just checking in about, I don't have a, it's kind of a conspiracy theory. I mean, sadly, conspiracy theories are becoming more reality. I was curious about your opinion on the timing of the five lawsuits brought against Trump. It seems like they were all brought about summer of last year when he announced his presidency. It just seems like really odd timing that right around he announces his presidency, they bring up some cases from, you know, even back to 2016, the Stormy Daniels stuff.
Yep. And by the way, Tim, it's not a conspiracy. I think it's deliberate. And you're right. If they wanted to take issue with the Stormy Daniels as a campaign contribution, they could have at least done it by 2017, because by that time he had run for office. The money was paid in late October of 2016, and they could have brought the case. If the Federal Elections Commission thought there was a case there, they could have brought the case 7 years ago. They did not. And why? Because the Federal Elections Commission looked at it and said, there's no case there. And the Department of Justice looked at it and said, there's no case there. And if you say, well, that was when Trump was president, you say, okay, start with when Joe Biden became president in 2021. Could the DOJ have brought a case against him then? They could have. They chose not to. They saw no criminal case there. And by the way, there's one that's the lawsuits are the E. Jean Carroll lawsuits. The rest of these are criminal charges. The criminal charges of fraud where there was no victim. The criminal charge of fraud that almost nobody can explain, this current case, which is a criminal case that could send the president to prison for decades. The criminal case involving the alleged inappropriate handling of classified documents, and election interference, the case in Fulton County, Georgia. Those are all criminal cases that have jail or prison consequences if you're convicted. I mean, this is serious stuff. Civil cases,
it really
you can usually resolve with money. Criminal cases send you to the joint.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of worried that with the case going to the jurors, that justice is going to come down to the jurors' political bias. I mean, and I say that even a, sorry, what was that?
I said it may, but I'm hoping that even with a biased New York City jury, that they're going to look at this and say, if they can do this to Donald Trump, could they do it to anybody else? In other words, if you're not a billionaire, if you're not a major businessman, if you're not a major celebrity, if you're not a former president, you're just an average guy. And Tim, I keep pointing out there are cases just like that, that the Biden Department of Justice, which is thoroughly bent and twisted and corrupt under both Joe Biden and Merrick Garland, the attorney general, you know, if you are a pro-life, I'm a pro-life person, you show up at a rally, you're involved in the rally, and one day you find an FBI SWAT team on your front porch, which has already happened. There is a woman who protested in favor of the right to life, and she is now sitting in prison on a 5-year sentence. 5 years. That happened just a few weeks ago. And you say, so if I don't agree with the point of view, the policies of the Biden administration, you can end up going to prison for years? And the answer is yes. So I hope that all of those New Yorkers say, hey, we may not like Donald Trump personally, but we're not going to let him be railroaded with these false charges and a cooked up case like Alvin Bragg brought. I think yesterday I might have called him something else, but it was clean. I just goofed his name. But imagine if you don't say, there but for the grace of God go I. Donald Trump's got lawyers. Donald Trump's got celebrities, got all those other things going for him. What happens when the average person is threatened with prison? Like the case of the Kenosha shooter.
Justice is no longer blind. It's got a laser focus is what it seems to me.
And it should be. Because, Tim, are you old enough to remember O.J. Simpson and the case, the criminal case against him?
I'm 31. I mean, I learned it in high school. I remember that the journalist came through and messed up the evidence, if I recall.
Well, one of the biggest concerns at the time was O.J.'s a celebrity. O.J.'s relatively wealthy, or used to be relatively wealthy. He was welcome in circles anywhere in America. He's dead now, but I mean, the fact is he was the toast of just about any place he went until he murdered his wife, and I believe he murdered his wife, and he was actually found civilly liable in the civil trial. But people worried at the time. They said, is celebrity and money going to outweigh justice? If this man really killed his wife, he should be held responsible, even if he is really wealthy, multimillionaire, even if he is very, very popular. He should not beat the charge just because of that. The alternate or the converse ought to be true as well, that if you say, well, what happens if you're not politically well-liked by half the population? And the Democrats and people like Joe Biden decide, we're going to go out and we're going to find this guy guilty of something, and it won't matter. He will not get equal justice. And if that's the way that America is going to be run, one of the reasons this country works is that people look at the law, and in general, most people follow the law, and they do so voluntarily. They don't really fear prison because they're not inclined to do the things that are illegal. But if all of a sudden they're told, even if you didn't do it, they can still find you guilty if your political position is unpopular, that is a scary Cuba-style America. You're listening to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on The Lars Larson Show.
Town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and here's a good X poll for Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Should government agencies like police and fire departments forbid their chaplains from praying in the name of Jesus Christ? Now, obviously, I have a bias in this. I'm a Protestant Christian. My Savior is Jesus Christ. I think there should be no problem with a chaplain offering a prayer in the name of Jesus. And yet, our friend Todd Starnes, who's one of my fellow tacos, he's in Memphis, he points out that police and fire chaplains in Carlsbad, California, have been ordered to stop praying in the name of Jesus. Pastor J.C. Cooper, who's been a volunteer chaplain for the last 6 years, he was asked to deliver the invocation at a police department awards ceremony. He concluded the prayer by invoking the name of, who else? Jesus Christ. And people objected. and said, you should tell that chaplain he can offer a prayer. He just can't mention the name of Jesus Christ. I think that's foolish. Should government agencies forbid praying in the name of Jesus? I'd say no. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. And brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I asked you, should government-run schools in the Northwest instruct students about Palestine, the non-existent country, as the unions plan to do? 93% of you joined me in a no vote on that. Only 7% of you said yes to that crazy idea. Now, I want to ask you a somewhat rhetorical question. Should you show up for your court hearing on the charge of driving with a suspended license and show up by appearing on a Zoom call while you're driving your car? It actually happened. Corey Harris is the defendant in this case. Ann Arbor, Michigan is where the court case was heard. He was supposed to show up at his Michigan court hearing. And when they dialed up the Zoom call to Corey Harris, the defendant charged with driving with a suspended license, take a listen to what happened.
Assistant Public Defender Natalie Tate for Mr. Harris, who should be present via Zoom.
Mr. Harris, hello. Are you driving?
That's the judge.
Actually, I'm pulling into my doctor's office, actually. So, just give me 1 second. I'm parking right now.
Now, that was District Judge Cedric Simpson in Ann Arbor, and you couldn't believe the look on this guy's face. So he's talking to a guy accused of driving with a suspended license. He has a suspended license, and he appears by Zoom call from behind the wheel of car as he's driving down the street. Take a listen to what the judge said.
Your Honor, we are respectfully requesting an adjournment in this matter, possibly 2 to 4 weeks if the court would allow.
So maybe I don't understand something. This is a driving with a license suspended?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And he was just driving, and he didn't have a license.
Now, can you imagine being the defense attorney in that case? This young lady is trying to do her best. Can we have a continuance for about 4 weeks? No, your client is accused of a crime that he appears to be committing right now. Take a listen again to what the public defender said about no license.
Is with the charges, Your Honor, yes.
No, I'm looking at his record. He doesn't have a license. He's suspended and he's just driving.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That is correct, Your Honor. And so the defense attorney said, well, you know, we can have a hearing another day and all that stuff. And guess what Judge Cedric Simpson of Ann Arbor decided to do? He said, no, this is how it's going to go for Mr. Corey Harris.
I don't even know why he would do that. So defendant's bond is revoked in this matter. Defendant is turning himself into the Washtenaw County Jail by 6 p.m. today. Failure to turn himself in will result in a bench warrant with no bond.
With no bond. I love it. Actually, a judge who has some real common sense says, no, when your client commits another crime while he's appearing in court for the same crime, he's going to go straight to jail, directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Let's go to your calls now. First to Rob. Hey, Rob, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call again. Trump sealed his fate back on February 20th of 2016 when he stated that there were no weapons of mass destruction, contrary to the Bush war that was started. And he is going to be found guilty, and he is going to go to jail, and he is going to go to the same jail that Epstein suicided himself in. So
no.
This has been in the planning stages. They're not going to let him be president at all.
Rob, first of all, about the jail he would go to would be Rikers Island. That's New York City's jail, or he'll go to a state facility. He's charged by the state of New York. Epstein was in federal custody.
I've heard both.
But let me ask you your theory on this. So your theory is the military-industrial complex would never allow somebody who said there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq justifying the war. They would never allow somebody like that to be elected. Is that your theory?
That is my theory.
Okay, hold on a second.
He said that
in March of 2016. Do you know what happened in November?
It was on Saturday, February 20th.
But in 2016, early 2016, do you recall what happened in November of 2016 to Donald Trump?
Oh, he became president.
Oh, but your theory was somebody who said that in the early part of 2016 couldn't become president. How did the military-industrial complex let him become president since he said that 6 months or 7 months earlier?
Well, what I'm saying is he sealed his fate to not be president again.
Again? Then why did the military-industrial complex let him become president the first time?
Well, that is a good question.
Well, I try to have good questions every day of the week. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and this is a perfect topic for a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And on this one, I've got a dog in the fight because I have to pay the tax as well. So Washington State, under the estimable leadership of somebody like Jay Inslee, comes up with this crazy idea called Washington Cares. Actually, a better name for it would be Washington doesn't really give a damn, but they'd like a piece of your paycheck. But that one was probably too long and clunky for them to get away with. So they impose this brand new tax for Washington Cares. And they say, why, you're going to pay this tax every year for a lot of years, and then someday you're probably not going to be able to get any benefit out of it at all. But we're going to put a warm, fuzzy name on it, and that'll make you feel better. Now, for a minor benefit you might get someday, or you might actually get denied because they put a bunch of fine print at the bottom that said all these people are not qualified to get a benefit for something they paid for. Now, if that doesn't sound like a state government program to you, I don't know what does. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. So the perfect person, the woman who's made it her cause to follow, well, she does follow a lot of other things as well, is Elizabeth New, who's a research analyst and director of the Centers for Workers' Rights and Healthcare at the Washington Policy Center. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Hello, Lars.
It's fair to say, isn't it?
Introduction. Sorry, go ahead. I'm a one-hit wonder on this.
No, you're not.
I'm a one-hit wonder on this.
No, but, you know, there are even topics where they say, oh, that's one of Lars's favorite topics. That's his hobby horse. And I've probably got a dozen of them. But there's nothing wrong, because if you aren't somebody who actually closely focuses on following something like this crazy might even be a billion-dollar boondoggle, Washington Cares, You lose track of what's going on. So welcome back to the program, by the way.
Thank you.
And tell me what, because we've literally been talking about Washington Cares for years when they first proposed it. And then when they said we're going to tax all the workers in Washington State, and then we're going to exclude a gigantic number of those workers and say, oh, sorry, yes, you paid for the benefit, but you aren't entitled because you moved out of state, because you didn't pay in long enough, this, that, and the other thing. And one of the first things you and I talked about is whether or not the money they were collecting from all the workers in the state of Washington would be enough to pay the tab. And if I remember right, both you and I agreed there will not be enough money to pay the tab. This thing will automatically run short of dough. Isn't that what we said a couple of years ago?
It's horribly worrisome. And even worse than people, workers, not getting a return on their investment is that this plan will not work. Reading numbers related to the cost of care increasing should make it clear to Washingtonians and lawmakers that the Washington Care Fund is not a good solution for our growing population. Lawmakers went down this wrong, easier road of taxing workers for something many will never see to try to solve Medicaid spending problems. They were handheld by a union, and they're creating more government dependency, not more self-sufficiency or solutions that can be found in a free market. The Bureau of Labor Statistics data data show that cost of home care rose 14.2% in 1 year alone.
Wow,
and another industry number says 10% across facility types. 36,500 is not going to be enough even to meet the needs for Washingtonians who do qualify for WellCares.
And assume this is all aimed at somebody who, prior to retirement years, finds themselves injured or some kind of illness that requires long-term care. That was the stated purpose of Washington Cares, right? But the maximum you can get out of it, lifetime benefit, is $36,500. And as you point out, a private room in a nursing home, assuming you need that level of care, that will pay, if you could get the whole $36,500 at once, it looks like it would pay for about 2 months of your care. And after that, you're back on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, estimates on the low end for long-term care services, they're finding a part-time home health aide in Washington State this year in Washington will cost around $43,000. And the private room, like you say, could run $169,000. So WellCares website says that its benefit of $36,500 could cover around 20 hours of care a week in the home for about a year. It's just misleading. It's time for the state to update its message and its website, because this is an inadequate benefit. It's not going to work.
Well, in fact, 20 hours a week, I mean, you're talking about a few hours a day, meaning you'd have to be dealing with somebody whose disability is so relatively minor that you might need help getting out of bed in the morning, maybe getting dressed, maybe set, you know, make breakfast and lunch for you, set aside some dinner in the fridge. That's about all a couple of hours a day is going to do for you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when you go to this cost of care website run by the industry leader, Genworth, you know, they put in the numbers 44 hours a week, because that's what people needing home health care are needing. And it's kind of a round-the-clock kind of deal with respite care coming in. So if you take that level of care, you're talking about care in the $90,000 range, not $43,000.
So now, is this thing still penciling out? Have they started paying benefits out of WellCares yet? Or is that just they're collecting the tax and they'll start paying people later? Where do we stand with that?
The latter. So they're collecting your taxes, and they plan to start paying in 2026 to the few people who will qualify on a revised vestment schedule. Most people won't be vested in the program and eligible for the money until they've paid in 10 years without a break of 5 or more years. And the worst part is, you know, we're looking at these increases, but the WellCares benefit since 2019 has stayed right where it's at. It's stayed stagnant. And they don't even plan to increase the amount to better reflect the cost of cares until 2027.
Now, by the way, about that five-year break, a break no longer than 5 years, isn't this automatically discriminatory against women? I mean, I know that despite
Absolutely.
The best efforts of the transgender crowd, women are still the ones who have babies. So if a woman... you know, married, has stopped from work, has a couple of kids, and stays home for 5 years, and then comes back to the workforce 6 years later after the birth of her first child, she's automatically excluded from benefits unless she puts 10 more years in, right?
Exactly. That's the point I've been trying to show up and make at the LTSS commission meetings, and they have recommended that it change, but lawmakers have not changed it, and I don't know that they will, because they need everyone paying into this that they can get. Another unfair provision is that you have to work 500 or more hours to count toward an eligible year in that 10 years. So you've got like entry-level workers who are working less than $500 a year, but they're being charged 58 cents for every $100 they make. They are not getting any eligibility attached to this contribution.
So as long as they're working part-time, they're not clocking in years. And even those of us working full-time, I think I started paying last year, might have been the year before. That means it'll be 2033 before I could even pretend to collect. That's Elizabeth New. Her research work is at the Washington Policy Center. She's the director of the Center for Worker Rights. Thank you, Elizabeth. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show.
unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you might remember, in 2008, America's economy fell off a cliff. And the proximate cause of that economic collapse, I mean, it affected everything. But it really began with real estate. It began with a giant pile of real estate because we gave loans out, or I didn't say we, the mortgage companies and the banks and the people who make home loans made home loans to people who had absolutely no likelihood of paying the money back. But it always worked out, or it worked out for several years, because people would buy a house for $300,000 and a year later it'd be worth $400,000, and nobody really cared what the house was really worth because they were all going up in value so fast and everybody was making money, and they had ninja loans like no income, no job loans, and no doc loans where you didn't have any documentation of your income. You just told the mortgage company, I make about this much money every year, and they'd hand you a home loan. And then when it all went bust, boy, it came apart fast. Well, guess what? One of the biggest mortgage lenders in America, and it's a company I'd never heard of, but United Wholesale Mortgage, one of the largest U.S. mortgage lenders, has an idea, and their bright idea is to loan people hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy homes with zero money down. And you say, well, that's a great deal. That's a great deal. As long as nothing goes backwards, as long as values don't fall, as long as nobody loses their job, and they're going to aim these zero down payment mortgages, they're going to aim them at people who make 80% of the median income in America. Now, it depends on where you live, but the median income is not a lot. So they're going to make zero down loans to people who are the most likely, if they're at the bottom of the economic scale, to lose a job, to suffer an economic setback, and to not be able to make the payments. Now, think about this. For those of you who've never owned a home, but even those of you who have owned a home or do own a home, you understand that one of the most powerful incentives for you to do everything, move heaven and earth to be able to make that mortgage payment, is because usually you're required to put down 5%, even 10%. Oftentimes a bank will require you to put 20% down. If you've got tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars, but usually at least tens of thousands of dollars that are invested in a house, you don't want to walk away from that. On the other hand, if you get a mortgage for zero down and you got no skin in the game, then walking away becomes a whole lot easier. This seems like one of the most colossally stupid ideas. I'll get into some of the details in a moment, but I want to grab some of your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, I'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to answer our poll on X, brand new question every day. Today, should government agencies like police and fire agencies forbid their chaplains from offering prayers if they mention the name of Jesus Christ? Well, for the majority of Americans who are Christians, the vast majority of Americans, having a prayer without Jesus Christ at the end of the prayer just doesn't happen. So I would say no, government agencies should not do that. Plus, I think, not being a lawyer, it crosses that First Amendment boundary as well. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. I take it, Casey, you want to talk about the Donald Trump trial? The latest one?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Lars. Yeah, I was shocked when I heard yesterday when President Trump spoke that the judge didn't allow his lawyers to call witnesses. How can that be constitutional?
Well, he didn't exclude all witnesses, so let's be precise about that. Because if I were to say the judge wouldn't allow Trump to call any witnesses, that's inaccurate, right? But if you said,
Trump was lying?
No, Trump wasn't lying.
Was lying.
No, I don't. Do you want me to answer your question or just keep talking over me? Because I get tired of that really fast.
Yeah, go ahead and do some turd shining.
The judge would not allow some witnesses to be called and would not allow some witnesses to be asked some questions. And judges regulate what the jury is allowed to hear in every single criminal trial on the planet. And what's crazy, I'll give you one of the examples of a witness the judge would not allow. there is a man who used to be the head of the Federal Elections Commission. And since this case turns on the question of whether or not Donald Trump paying the NDA, non-disclosure agreement money to Stormy Daniels, was said to be an elections contribution to his own campaign, which was false. And the former head of the Federal Elections Commission was going to testify about whether or not paying an NDA as a private individual could all, you know, would be considered a contribution to his own election. And the judge would not allow the former head of the Federal Elections Commission to testify. So when Trump said the judge wouldn't let us call witnesses, that is true. He didn't say they wouldn't let him call any witness. They just, there were certain witnesses the judge would not let the jury hear.
Ah, I see. Yeah, Trump would never lie or anything like that. Thanks for clearing that up.
Well, Casey, can you tell me the most notorious lie you can remember Donald Trump saying?
Let me think for a second.
I think you might have to think longer than that. Say again?
The election was stolen?
That was accurate.
Oh, yeah.
It's also an opinion.
What do you think about Chris Krebs and what he said about the election?
I don't recall what Chris Krebs said. Can you refresh my memory?
Yeah, do you know who Chris Krebs is?
Boy, you know what, Casey? I'm not here to answer every question you want to ask. If you want to make a point, make your point.
Chris Krebs was Trump's election specialist and internet specialist. Mm-hmm. A few days after the election, Chris Krebs came out and said, yeah, we lost. This was a free and fair election. What do you think happened to Chris Krebs later that day?
Probably got fired.
Yes, he was fired.
Casey, have you ever worked at a job where you had a strong opinion and it was different than the boss?
How about the attorney general?
No, answer my question first, Casey. I agreed to answer your questions. You answer my question.
Yes, bosses will fire people with strong opinions.
Yeah, especially when somebody comes in and directly contradicts the boss, says the boss is wrong about this, and it's something as consequential as an election. I know you just want to call Trump a liar, but in this case, Trump is right. Judge Mershon, who's about as bent as the day is long, I mean, Judge Mershon has a dog in the fight all day long and twice on Sunday. He was allegedly randomly chosen. Now get this, 28 judges that could have been chosen to oversee several Donald Trump criminal trials, one civil trial and two criminal trials. And Judge Mershon managed to get chosen three times in a row, randomly, to oversee the Trump cases. Now, you might say, well, that's a strange coincidence that they kept choosing a Democrat Party donor, a guy whose daughter makes a six-figure salary, raising millions of dollars for top-name Democrats in America. And somehow this is the guy who's got a dog in the fight all day long. He gets chosen not once, not twice, but three times randomly to oversee the Trump case. And then he makes biased decisions from behind the bench. He excludes witnesses who would have had something very important to say. If the whole case is about whether or not the money paid to Stormy Daniels was a campaign contribution, wouldn't you think the testimony of the former head of the Federal Elections Commission on that subject would have been relevant to the trial? Judge Mershon, the bent judge from New York City, did not think so. And you've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. You can literally have Lars with you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I always tell you that if I have a dog in the fight, I'll confess it. I own guns. I believe in the Second Amendment. I am biased in favor of the individual constitutional God-given right to keep and bear firearms. So I'm clearly biased on this one. And I was so happy to see a ruling from the United States Supreme Court that says, yep, The government went in and violated the constitutional rights of the National Rifle Association. I got another bias there. I'm a member of the group, although I've quit the group occasionally when I've had big disagreements with them. I wanted to get to Brian Knight, who's an attorney and senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, to talk about the consequences of this decision. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to make sure I properly characterize, thank you for coming on, I want to make sure I properly characterize what the court has done. The court said, in essence, when a government agency goes out, or a person working for a government agency goes out and actively tries to get people who support a free speech group like the NRA to say stop supporting the NRA and leans on those groups, they're way over that First Amendment line. Is that a proper characterization of what the court decided was wrong for New York State to do to the NRA?
Well, so I'll do that annoying attorney thing and quibble slightly.
Okay, please do.
So, first off, it's important for your listeners to understand that where this case is at a motion to dismiss stage. So, we haven't actually, like, a court has not found facts yet. Basically, Maria Vullo, the former superintendent of the NYDFS, said, look, even if everything the NRA alleged I did is true, that's still not a violation of the law. And the trial court disagreed and refused to grant a motion to dismiss. She then appealed that up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which agreed with her and said, yeah, look, everything the NRA alleges in this case, even if true, is not a violation of the First Amendment. It's not a violation of the law. It's not a problem. And what the Supreme Court did in this decision is reversed that and said, if it's true that the that Maria Vullo, in her capacity as a regulator, leaned on banks and leaned on insurance companies to cut ties with the NRA because she wanted to hurt the NRA's ability to advocate for the Second Amendment, that's a First Amendment violation.
Yep.
We still need to go, you know, presumably this case is being remanded back to the Second Circuit. If it does get remanded back to the trial court, we're still going to have to have the trial, and we're still going to have to, like, find some facts. And it's possible that a jury might find that, in fact, there was no coercion or whatever. But what the upshot of this case is, or one of the big upshots of this case, is that a regulator can't hide behind the notion of, well, I'm not doing anything directly to the NRA or whomever. I'm just regulating, intermediaries, in this case, banks and insurance companies. And so that's okay. It also, I think, removes their ability to hide behind things like, well, look, I just provided guidance. one of the allegations in the case is that she, Maria Vullo, put up two guidance documents to banks and insurance companies regulated in New York and said, in effect, guns are bad. We really should have more gun control. You banks and insurance companies need to be worried about the potential damage to your reputation from doing business with groups like with the NRA and groups like the NRA. And by the way, you have a regulatory obligation to manage your reputation risk. And the Second Circuit said, well, look, that's fine. There's no threat there. The language doesn't include
hold
a threat.
Hold on. The regulator who regulates banks is telling the banks, you ought to be worried about your regulation. And they'll look at her and say, this woman determines whether or not we can keep doing the business we're doing in the state of New York. Don't they? Or doesn't she?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so that was one of the, and full disclosure, I co-authored an amicus brief in this case on this, in support of the NRA, on this very topic, this notion that when a financial regulator says to the regulated entities it oversees, hey, you ought to be worried about something, those entities don't say, okay, that's interesting, and move on. They say, oh, okay, well, we do need to be concerned about this because the regulator has a million different ways to make our life miserable if we don't go along.
I mean, this is one where, Brian, I have to tell you, it's a unanimous decision, 9-0, and that's about half the decisions from SCOTUS this last term. But I thought, I don't often, as you might imagine, get the chance to quote Sonia Sotomayor in a positive light, but she wrote, the court holds that the NRA plausibly alleged, they made a good argument, that Vullo violated the First Amendment by coercing regulated entities to terminate their business relationships. I'm actually agreeing with Sonia Sotomayor. I mean, it's a red letter day for me.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about this case, and part of it is because this is at the motion to dismiss stage, the court is supposed to assume all the facts in favor or give the most plausible positive reading of the facts in favor of the NRA. So, you know, no one's determined what's happened, but just like if this did happen, would it be a problem? And the court unequivocally says yes. But also, I think what this case shows is that, you know, the court is concerned about the threat to the First Amendment from regulators trying to use, you know, some relatively narrow, perhaps important, but narrow scope of authority as a tool of universal regulation, right? You know, if you're Maria Vullo, you may want to increase gun control, but you can't. But what you can do is lean on the essential financial arteries that everyone relies on, including the NRA and other Second Amendment promotion groups, and say, okay, well, look, I may not be able to do anything directly, but I can try to cut them off indirectly through my regulation of finance. And, you know, Justice Sotomayor points out that, you know, what this case stands for, and it's part of a line of cases, is you can't do indirectly what you're not allowed to do directly. And that's a really important rule.
And Brian, isn't this the essence of choke point, the idea that Obama had to say, oh, we can't outlaw guns, we can't get that passed on Capitol Hill, but we can sure go in and throttle down their financing, their credit cards, and everything else. These regulators have the power to put the gun business out of business, saying, well, it's not illegal to sell guns here. We're just going to make it impossible for anybody to run a business that makes or sells guns.
So with the obnoxious attorney caveat that the exact scope of choke point is in dispute, I think what is not in dispute is that we do have examples, and we cite some in the brief I co-authored, where you do have federal bank regulators leaning on banks because they don't like some downstream product. The examples that have the most sort of evidence behind them are payday loans and refund anticipation loans, where the FDIC's inspector general found that FDIC employees would lean on banks who did business with those firms, be like, look, this stuff is bad, and while we don't have a legal hook to straight up outlaw it, we can lean on the banks that are helping them to pressure them to cut ties, to make it not worth their efforts to cut ties. And you could imagine this being used against firearms makers, and maybe it has been. Like I said, there's dispute about the exact scope of choke point. You could imagine this being used against fossil fuel companies.
Yep.
You could imagine this being used, but on the other hand, like, look, you could imagine this being used against groups that the right doesn't like either. You know,
that's absolutely right. That's Brian Knight. Brian, thanks for the time. He's an attorney and senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. I'm glad to see that 9-0 decision. I'm glad to see Sonia Sotomayor finally come over to the right side in favor of guns. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest.
Before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
A verdict has been reached in Donald Trump's latest criminal trial in New York. If you haven't heard the news already, in the last few minutes, we've heard the jury has asked the judge for another 30 minutes to fill out all the paperwork that goes with their verdict. So, do we know what the verdict is? No. But I've sat through a lot of these in criminal trials, and here's how the process is going to go. If they've asked for another 30 minutes, and I believe that request was probably made about 15 minutes ago, that means sometime just after the top of the hour, the jury is going to be called in first. Everybody will reenter the courtroom. Defense team and Donald Trump, prosecution team and Crooked Alvin Bragg. and Judge Mershon. And when everybody is seated, including all of the people sitting in the gallery, then they'll bring the jury in. And then the judge is going to say to the jury, to the foreman of the jury, who I think is a young lady, Madam Foreperson, have you reached a verdict? And she will say, yes, may I see it? It's handed over to the judge. The judge reads it, hands it back, and says, would the jury foreperson please read the verdict? And so the verdict will be delivered. Now, I've told you before, I have remained confident that at least one member of that 12-member jury, having deliberated now 5 hours yesterday, and it appears close to 6 or 7 hours today, that they have finally reached a verdict. And apparently it was not the let's go into the jury room, talk for an hour or two, have lunch, and come out with a verdict yesterday. It took them some time. And so they've been considering it. I think that was good news for Donald Trump. Do I believe that they could deliver an acquittal? Yeah. And I could be wrong. I mean, I've been wrong before. It'll be nothing new for me. But I think they're going to deliver an acquittal. And I think this is going to be explosive. Now, on the other hand, if they find him guilty, which is also a possibility, I mean, my crystal ball is not always as clear as everybody else's crystal ball, but if they find Donald Trump guilty of a crime that is a federal crime, a state conspiracy based on state laws for which the statute of limitations ran out 5 years ago in 2019, it is going to send a couple of messages. Number one, I think Donald Trump this fall is going to win in a landslide because Americans will have seen that an American president, Joe Biden, has helped to coordinate this trial and the other criminal trials against Donald Trump in an effort to illegally interfere with an election. That's what they're doing. I mean, there's no secret about it. This case in particular could have been brought in 2017, 2018, could have even been brought in 2021 after Joe Biden first became president. Joe Biden's own Department of Justice said, we're not going to bring a charge against Donald Trump for the NDA payment that was made to Stormy Daniels. That was what the DOJ decided. The Federal Election Commission under Joe Biden could have brought a case. They decided there was no case there. And then Alvin Bragg, who had campaigned on the idea that he would get Donald Trump one way or another, manages to invent this cobbled up case. And then he gets a crooked judge like Judge Mershon and a crooked system. And I pointed this out to you before. If you say, well, Lars, how can you call the system, the judicial system in New York State crooked? Let me tell you how I can call it crooked. In New York State, by the court's own rules, they are supposed to choose every judge for every criminal case at random, which means that if you're a criminal defendant, you don't say, oh, well, if the system doesn't like you, if the governor doesn't like you or the mayor doesn't like you or the president doesn't like you, at least you get a judge assigned at random. And then consider the fact that this is the third case against Donald Trump that's been heard before Judge Mershon. And you say, well, hold on. There are 28 judges they could have chosen from. They choose the judges randomly for various cases. And Judge Mershon gets picked three times to hear a Donald Trump case, three times in a row out of 28. What are the odds? I can't do the statistical math, but I can tell you it doesn't sound random to me. But just in case you haven't heard, a verdict has been reached by the jury in New York City in the criminal case against Donald Trump. And as we've talked about before, a case that is so darned convoluted that it's hard to even explain. Most criminal cases, you say, what's the guy accused of? Rape, murder, assault, whatever it happens to be. I mean, even with January 6th, you could say, well, they were accused of property destruction or they were accused of criminal trespass or things like that. In this case, you have to explain, well, there's this state law where the statute of limitations ran out 5 years ago, and he may have violated that, but there was no case there, and that's only a misdemeanor anyway. But it's a felony because Alvin Bragg managed to drag in a federal law that he violated. And you say, well, can the local DA in Manhattan bring a federal charge against? No, he can't, but he's doing it anyway. And then the crazy jury instruction that were given earlier this week, you know, when the judge sent them out to deliberate, and the judge told them, you don't all have to agree on what the criminal, the crime was that Donald Trump committed, but you have to agree that he committed some crime, one of the crimes that is alleged. It is the most bizarre jury instruction I have ever heard of in my life, and I've covered roughly 100 criminal trials in the last 40 years. And it's bizarre that a judge would say, well, yeah, you don't all have to agree on what crime he committed. You just have to agree that he did something criminal, because that's what gets them into court at all. If you agree that he violated federal election law, that he conspired to hide the information, and none of that makes sense anyway. If Donald Trump thought giving Stormy Daniels money was a campaign paid, you know, kind of event, he could have used money from his campaign. He had lots of it. Instead, he paid it out of his own personal funds, even though if he had made it a campaign contribution, he could have said, I'm going to pay the money that way, and it won't be reported until after the 2016 election. We'll find out what the verdict is in the next hour. You got the Lars.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You all ready?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And as I told you last hour, a verdict has been reached in the New York criminal trial of Donald Trump. I'm going to stick with my prediction that he's going to get acquittal. There's at least one common sense juror among the 12. But there are a lot of other things. Until that jury actually reenters the courtroom, delivers its verdict, and is made public, we'll let you know the minute we find out what the verdict is. I wish we had cameras in the courtroom, but we do not. In the meantime, I want to talk to our friend Jonathan Cho, the journalist with the Discovery Institute, about some big changes that are happening involving Seattle and its police chief, and why Seattle Police Chief Aaron Diaz suddenly Adrian Diaz suddenly chose the exit door from the office of chief. Jonathan, welcome back.
Yeah, hey, Lars. I'm not quite sure he chose this. He was sort of nudged into resignation and now into this new special projects position within SPD. But yeah, a new day. Today's the first day for interim chief Sue Rohr. It's going to be temporary, and the mayor is hoping to fill this position in the next 6 to 9 months.
See, now the reason we talked to you, Jonathan, is that you got the inside track on this. He was nudged, but was he nudged because the city still has a major problem and has one of the lowest levels of police officers it's had in decades, or was there some other reason?
Well, look, the elephant in the room is the looming complaints. I mean, Chief Diaz, for months now, has really been facing all kinds of these allegations, gender and racial discrimination allegations, and is about to face lawsuits. So this was a distraction, and this is not what Mayor Bruce Harrell wanted for his administration, as the city's trying to, you know, turn over a new leaf and also, again, as you mentioned, recruit new officers. The problem here now, and I was at that press conference yesterday when they made this announcement, there are now concerns that Chief Diaz wasn't given due process. Again, let me be very clear. He has not been found guilty of anything yet. So there are obviously many supporters, especially in communities of color here, especially the black community in South Seattle. You had a reverend in the room. You had a community activist in the room. And they were very disappointed and criticized the mayor at his own press conference about this decision.
So tell me this. You've got a person of color as the chief who's been accused of racial discrimination as the chief. And now they're going to boot Diaz or nudge him toward the door. By the way, the jury's now entered the courtroom in New York City. That means the verdict could be a few minutes away, but we'll let you know as we find out. Jonathan, what? Well, we just got the word, Jonathan. Donald Trump guilty in New York City. My prediction was wrong. Donald Trump has been found guilty in that trial. This means he wins in a landslide this fall, and the liberals can all run around and celebrate now. But, Jonathan, going back to Diaz, what is it he's accused of doing?
Yeah, he's accused of essentially grooming and having inappropriate, you know, interactions with some female cops. A couple other officers have also come out and accused him of retaliation. And look, the allegations and the people coming forward in such a short amount of time was just too much for Mayor Harrell. But again, on the flip side of that, I want to be very clear. There's usually a process. We call it due process. And that's, again, Diaz's supporters are saying, wait, he hasn't been found guilty of anything. Why not let this investigation play out? Why not, you know, have some official, you know, outcome before making a call like this? So, again, it's a controversial move by Mayor Harrell, but he's willing to make it. And I want to be very clear. He is, Chief Diaz is still with SPD. He is going to be in a quote-unquote special projects role. We don't know exactly what that looks like. But he has not been fired or let go from SPD.
Well, and doesn't that raise the question, if he's accused of sexual offenses, he hasn't, or sexual grooming and harassment and that sort of thing, and you're going to move him out of the office of chief but leave him at the bureau, even though those are still hanging there? I agree with you. He has a right to due process. He should have a hearing. He should be able to, you know, he should be able to produce evidence. The accusation should be backed up or not. And then decide if he's really guilty of doing some terrible things to people within the department. Maybe he shouldn't be in the department at all. But how do they choose this halfway spot, Lars?
I asked that very question. Great observation. Because at the end of the day, he's still with SPD, and I asked, wouldn't this be a distraction for especially all the other officers if you're really trying to move forward this? And it's really, the mayor yesterday was talking out of both sides of his mouth, saying, you know, Chief Diaz, he needs to have due process. He served for 27 years at SPD, and that's why we're keeping him. He brings great knowledge and connections to the community. But then on the other side, he'll say, well, we also need a fresh start. We need to move on. We can't have this hanging over SPD, especially as we're trying to change the culture. So, again, we'll just have to wait and see exactly what this new role is going to be. And, of course, there are looming investigations still around Diaz. So this will still stay with the Harrell administration.
Well, I'm imagining this, Jonathan. You're right. When the mayor says we don't need this distraction, but we're going to move him out of his role as chief, still in the department, still under investigation, still, you know, undetermined whether or not he did these things, the first question that Bruce Harrell is going to get at every news conference between now and probably this fall, and the first question that the new chief is going to get at every press conference is, you know, what about Adrian Diaz? Because it's going to continue to be a major distraction. By the way, guilty on all 34 counts in New York City for Donald Trump. I think Americans now see how the criminal justice system both works and does not work in this case. But Jonathan, doesn't this continue to be, it will then dominate just about everything the mayor and the new chief of police do.
Yeah, I mean, if the local Seattle media does its job, I mean, this is going to still be the top story until a new chief is named, until these investigations are over. So again, if the mayor's goal was to move on from Diaz and Diaz not being a distraction, I think that's far from the case right now. And again, you have these community activists who, again, are fighting for justice, who do believe in the law, saying he's not getting his due process right now. And we're talking about Chief Diaz, that is.
And I guess when somebody becomes inconvenient to politicians like Bruce Harrell, then you say, well, we don't care if they get due process or not. And that doesn't seem like to be a very justifiable reason. What does that say to every other cop? I mean, what they got? They're down to 900 cops. What does it say to every other cop or potential hire at Seattle PD saying, yeah, if somebody accuses you of something, you're going to be punishment first, trial later?
Yeah, exactly. And that was brought up several times, not only by journalists, but some of the activists in the room. What type of message and precedent does this set now? You know, that if there's an allegation or two right away, you're going to be removed from that position. And, you know, the mayor decides to become judge, jury, and executioner before any type of, you know, trial or due process. And that's problematic. Yet the mayor, who was a attorney before coming into this role as the top leader here in Seattle, he chalked that up to saying we can both have due process and move on. But the final question didn't have an answer for Lars was, what if he's found innocent of all these allegations? Then what? And then the mayor said, and I put this up on my social media, he didn't have an answer for that. He said, quote, I don't know.
So in other words, we took you out of the spot for the things you do, and when they did, and then when we determined you didn't actually do those things, how do you make it all right again? That's Jonathan Cho, journalist at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Back in a moment. Donald Trump, guilty on all 34 charges. We'll get your phone calls and your emails in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show in the Radio Northwest.
on demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Let's go live right now to New York City, where Donald Trump, just convicted on 34 counts in that criminal trial, is speaking now. Let's take a listen.
Fighting for our Constitution. Our whole country is being rigged right now. This was done by the Biden administration in order to wound or hurt an opponent, a political opponent. And I think it's just a disgrace. And we'll keep fighting. We'll fight till the end and we'll win, because our country's gone to hell. We don't have the same country anymore. We have a divided mess. We're a nation in decline, serious decline. Millions and millions of people pouring into our country right now from prisons and from mental institutions, terrorists, and they're taking over our country. We have a country that's in big trouble, but this was a rigged decision right from day one with a conflicted judge who should have never been allowed to try this case, never. And we will fight for our Constitution. This is long from over. Thank you very much.
Let's see if he answers any more questions. It sounds like Donald Trump will not take any more more than the statement that he's just offered up. But that was Donald Trump live from New York City, where just moments ago a jury decided that he is guilty. As many people predicted, I thought there'd be at least one common sense juror on that jury out of 12 who would say the state, number one, brought charges that were false from the beginning. They charged him with failing to properly falsified business records, is the way it was stated. Falsifying business records was the crime. And you say, well, that's a misdemeanor crime in New York City. How did it become a felony? It became a felony because Alvin Bragg, the DA, said, well, I can't charge him with that misdemeanor because the statute of limitations, believe it or not, has run out 5 years in the past. 2019 is when the statute of limitations ran out on a charge of falsifying business records. And you say, well, what kind of trial was this? In fact, if any of your friends say, well, did you hear about the decision on the hush money? He paid the illegal hush money. No, the hush money was not illegal. The hush money was completely legal, and many companies and individuals pay for NDAs. I don't have a dog in the fight on there. I have been paid when I left work for some companies in non-disparagement agreements, but I wasn't planning to disparage anybody anyway. But in this case, they found him guilty on 34 counts of falsifying business records because they insisted that the contribution, the money that was paid to Stormy Daniels, was in fact a campaign contribution under federal law. Again, federal law that Alvin Bragg, the DA of Manhattan, has absolutely no authority to enforce at all. And you say, well, then what was the case? That he conspired to do it. Listen, Donald Trump knows how to pinch pennies when he needs to. And if he had thought, well, this is a campaign expense, he could have easily had his campaign pay the money to Stormy Daniels. Now, why didn't he do that? Because it wasn't a campaign event. It was a personal matter that he wanted to keep personal, and he wanted Stormy Daniels to stop saying the false story that she has said all along. Trump has always maintained there was never a one-night stand with Stormy Daniels. Stormy Daniels says there was, although her story has changed enough over the years to make you doubt that. Let me get some of your calls, too. And if Trump speaks again or others involved, I'd love to say I'm sure Alvin Bragg will be out to take a victory lap. And we all know to a fair certainty this thing is going to do two things. Number one, it's going to ensure that even more people are going to vote for Donald Trump. They might have said, I don't like the guy. I don't like his tweets. But I'll tell you what, I don't like the fact that the Biden administration has engineered four different criminal matters against a political opponent the way you see third world dictatorships and places like Russia and China and Cuba and Venezuela operate. That is the Biden regime right now. So let's go to your calls. Start with Craig. Maybe I'll get a naysayer at 866-439-5277. Craig, what do you make of the verdict?
Well, Mr. Lars, I think it's very disappointing just from a right is right, wrong is wrong basis. I feel also, and I do have a question for you, but I also feel this may be also why the Democrats are not worried about the polls, because they know they're going to cheat again, and it doesn't really matter how people vote. My question is for you, wouldn't it be interesting if on the first debate stage, Biden and Trump could shake hands with Biden pardoning Trump and saying to America, no matter what these cases come about, we're going to pardon this president, because this is not what democracy looks like.
Why would Joe Biden, who engineered this whole thing, his fingerprints are all over this. They're all over the Mar-a-Lago raid. They're all over the Fannie Willis down in Fulton County, Georgia. I mean, her lover that she paid several $100,000 to investigate Donald Trump. He had numerous White House meetings. When his fingerprints are all over it, why would Joe Biden, what would be the benefit to Joe of pardoning Donald Trump?
If he doesn't pardon Trump, it just shows exactly what you said to be true, Lars.
I think if he does pardon Donald Trump, it might show that. But that's my answer to that question. I don't think there's any chance in the world. If Joe Biden pardoned Donald Trump, can you imagine the reaction from his own party? But it's an interesting thought. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Welcome to Joe Crow America. Basically what they basically said, I can take a law from the federal that the legislative of that state did not vote for, and push it on somebody. And I'll be honest with you. You know me, Lars, for years, over 20 years, I care about people. But the decision showed me that because of education on pushing ideology of the Fabian socialists of the 1880s has dumbed down that generation that was in that courtroom. They have no common sense. They walk away from faith value or human values in general. And the last point I will make is, this here is, if it happens to Trump, am I next because I speak up against Speaker Rayfield?
Possibly. Because, Ron, you understand, Americans, whether they agree with them or not, I go back to that Martin Niemöller poem from World War II, where he said, well, they came for the socialist workers, and I wasn't one of those, so I didn't stand up. And then they came for another group, and I wasn't one of those, so I didn't stand up. And when they finally came for me, there was nobody to stand up. Americans ought to be asking themselves, if you're taking a position that is politically unpopular with a current ruling class, like a pro-life position, will you find yourself in federal prison the way one young lady got sentenced to federal prison 2 weeks ago, and she's going to spend 5 years in prison for simply standing up for the right to life? And you say, well, that won't happen to me. Really? Because what do you think dictatorships like this one? And Joe Biden really is, he is a false president. He was not elected. You're right. The previous caller was right. They did cheat. But there's one secret. If the win is big enough, they can't cheat. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, thanks for the call from Seattle. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I agree. This trial was dumb. And it was politically motivated. I voted for Trump in 2016 and 2020. I agree with most of his policies, but I just can't support the clown show, you know, and the Republican Party needs to do better. We need
what
to move
clown,
on.
But what clown show? The clown show run by Joe Biden getting his political opponent indicted in four different cases?
Well, no, I'm not trying to argue with you. I mean,
no, I'm just asking, which clown show are you referring to?
Both of them. I mean, yeah, the Biden thing, the whole Democrat, you know, it's politically motivated.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, Jim, thanks very much. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I was looking forward to talking to Lance LaRusso, our friend who's an attorney and former law enforcement and the author of a number of great books, all of which, the two of them benefit police charities, one of them in particular, Blue News, because I want to talk to him about the crazy stuff that Boston's mayor is doing, literally telling the criminal crowd there are a whole bunch of crimes we're not going to prosecute. We're not going to seek any kind of justice for the victim against the criminal. Lance, welcome back to the program. But can I start first with your opinion on what has happened in New York City with a jury finding Donald Trump guilty on 34 counts of falsifying business records?
You know, I have not followed all of the trial like some people have been glued to it, but it is pretty amazing. And keep in mind, everybody's saying there's going to be an appeal. One of the primary facets of an appeal is there is a presumption in favor of a jury verdict. So this is going to be a very, very interesting situation. The judge did not say he would entertain any arguments. It doesn't look, I'm sure they're going to make some motions for a directed verdict as a matter of law to overturn the jury verdict. The judge, as far as I saw, just said there will be a sentencing and gave a date and a time.
Yeah, July the 11th, I believe that's 3 days before the Republican National Convention. Do you think that anybody is going to have a tough time believing that all of this was politically motivated?
You know, it's kind of interesting. Even if somebody wanted to believe it, there's been so much hype about this. It's kind of what I said about the election when people were talking about it. You know, whether or not do you believe the election results? The fact that people are doubting it means we need to do better. People should have faith in the jury system. They should have faith in the election system. They should have faith in the voter process. And it's very, very concerning to me that people are so polarized about this trial itself. And, you know, and it's not just the trial. It's not just the verdict. People have been polarized about the selection of these charges against this defendant since it was first discussed.
Well, I don't know if this one's going to be a grounds for appeal, because a lot of people think you can just appeal and say, hey, would you take another look at it? You've got to have grounds. And in this case, state right. grounds to begin with. And then later, if you can find a federal constitutional issue, then you can take it to the federal courts. But let me give you one example that seems especially troubling to me, especially if you think about how Americans think they might be treated in a system. So you say, well, what was he found guilty of? Falsifying business records. Well, that expired 5 years ago. Can you still try that one now? Yeah, we can, because it's also a federal violation of election law. And you say, okay, was that looked at by the federal authorities who usually prosecute that stuff? Yeah, it was. Did they decide to bring a case 7 years ago on the Stormy Daniels money as a federal election law violation? And you say, yeah, they looked at it. The DOJ looked at it. They all decided there was no case there. You say, okay, so we're going to charge you with this crime. And the defendant and his attorneys say, we'd like to bring in the former head of the Federal Elections Commission to talk about whether or not the money paid to this woman was an election contribution, you know, an illegal contribution to Donald Trump's campaign, because he was going to testify, and he already said he was going to testify, that it was not. And that's why they didn't bring a case. And the judge, Judge Mershon, who, at least to me, Lance, seems bent six ways from Sunday, said, no, you're not allowed to let that guy testify. And I thought, even if I step back from my pro-Trump partisanship and said, okay, if I looked at this generically, I'm being tried for making an illegal campaign contribution, and my attorneys want to bring an expert in campaign contributions who used to head the Federal Election Commission, and the judge says I can't have that guy testify? I mean, that doesn't sound like any kind of justice, no matter which side of the aisle you fall on when it comes to Trump or Biden, does it?
Yeah. And, well, it's interesting, because a lot of those questions as to who can testify and who can't have to do with the rules of evidence. And I think that there's been a lot of misunderstanding of some of the basic things that happened in the court. So, for example, when the jury was done, when the closing arguments were done, and Judge Mershon said, OK, I'm going to give you some instructions, but first, nothing the lawyers said is evidence. The lawyers don't tell you what the law is. You should seek the law solely from my instruction in the court. People came out and condemned the judge for that. That is a basic legal instruction. That is a correct statement of the law in every case. So,
I didn't take issue with that one, Lance, because I've heard judges give that instruction as well.
Right.
Somebody talking as your lawyer is not evidence. Evidence is either physical evidence you've looked at, or say a police officer saying, I was at the scene and I saw the weapon in the defendant's hand and his hand was covered with blood. That testimony would be evidence. The gun would be evidence. The blood would be evidence. What the lawyer says about it is not. That's an easy one.
Right, and that's why I'm saying there were a lot of people who are criticizing that. The interesting thing that I'm still digesting, and I'm trying to find some articles on it, you know, there were a lot of questions about the credibility of some of the witnesses the prosecution brought up.
Like
we were talking about on the appeal, right. Well, the part of the problem that you bring up on the appeal is the credibility of a witness, the sole judge of the credibility of a witness, not only whether they're credible and how much credibility to give and how much weight to give their testimony,
yeah.
The sole judge of that is the jury.
Yeah.
So if the jury found him credible, you know, that's they're entitled to do that. And I think one of the things that everybody's going to be second guessing for forever through the end of time is why Trump didn't take the stand. And it could be, and I have seen situations, he has a right to remain silent. He has a right to not say anything. But a lot of times, and they're going to be polling these jurors, they're going to talk to these jurors, people are going to go interview them, some of them may do interviews, then it's going to be very interesting if they just sat there and said, we wanted to hear it directly from him.
And I get that. The other piece on the evidence that really bothered me, Lance, you and I both know, and you're a former cop, you're an attorney, I'm just a reporter, but I follow these cases, this idea of probative value. And I remember this, I mean, because you walk in a court trial, you say, we're going to show the jury a picture of a dead body, you know, the body of the victim. And, okay, we'd like to show the jury 1,000 pictures of all the bloody mayhem that happened at the crime scene. And the judge says that doesn't have probative value, let's say, because, you know, you're just showing them more pictures of blood and gore, and it's going to inflame the jury. This judge allowed the prosecutor to bring in Stormy Daniels to talk about how many clothes she was still wearing when they had sex, allegedly, and, you know, how the removal of the clothing happened. And I thought, that's way over the line. It has no probative value to whether or not an illegal federal campaign contribution was made and whether or not the business records are. Well, why are you doing this just to get the jury all fired up by hearing all the nitty gritty details of sex on a hotel bed? And then after he allowed her to testify, he then criticized the prosecution for having their witness testify that way.
Right. And what you're talking about is basically there's a balancing act as to whether or not the testimony either goes over the bounds or essentially it's more prejudicial than probative. So if you can bring in information and prove the point, there's no reason to go overboard or bring something, like you said, 7 pictures of the body laying on the ground instead of one that says there's a knife sticking out of the body. So you know how that the knife penetrated their chest. So if there's going to be a lot of issues, there's going to be a lot of people going back through. His defense team probably has been evaluating any grounds for appeal. And grounds for appeal are not looked at by lawyers after the case. You go through every single ruling of the court, every single piece of evidence that was admitted, not admitted, every single motion where you were denied or the prosecution was granted. And it seems like this trial went on a long time, and there's kind of a saying among trial lawyers, the longer the trial goes on, the more chance there is for an appealable error. And I think the question really is going to come down, as you mentioned, the timing of the Republican National Convention. The timing is really going to come down as to whether the appellate court will hear this in time to really make a difference.
That's a very good point. That's Lance LaRusso, attorney and the author of Blue News that benefits police charities. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and Donald Trump's family.
The voice of the people. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. As you probably know, less than an hour ago, a decision from a New York City jury of 12 finding Donald Trump guilty on all 34 criminal counts against him. The case involving falsification of business records, for which the statute of limitations ran out 5 years ago, and a federal crime, which the DA in Manhattan can't charge, but he did, and a jury that was picked from Manhattan and was predicted to produce a guilty verdict. I predicted that at least one of them would be common sense and would say, no, the state has not proved its case. I was completely wrong, so I'll fess up to that. By the way, this segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, and sentencing for Donald Trump is July the 11th, 3 days before the Republican National Convention. But, oh, no, there was nothing political about this case at all. And I knew I'd get at least a few naysayers. And you're invited to sound off at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, you can join me. We'll always put you first at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. JC, you are a naysayer. We must disagree about something. What is it?
Well, yes, thanks for taking my call. We obviously disagree with the verdict. I agree with it. You disagree with it. I think the jury, whether I like it or not, they did what they had to do and found him guilty. I heard Eric Adams, the mayor of New York, was getting the Trump Institute for Idiots, Rikers Island, ready for him. Do you think that's where he's going to end up, where he's going to have, like, home confinement down in Mar-a-Lago? And I'm going to tell you why the reason he was found guilty, you should have known this. You're a very smart guy, and your listeners are very smart. His wife, Melania, had nothing to do with it. She was not present, didn't even show her face. All he had is all his hoodlums show up, try to defend him, look more like a funeral than a defense for him.
Hey, help me out with this. Since you're an ace here and we disagree, what did he do that broke the law?
Obviously, I don't know all the facts.
If we just saw the criminal conviction for the first time in American history of an American president and a presidential candidate, you must know what he did. What did he do that broke the law?
Well, one thing that he didn't do, he didn't get up on the stand and speak for a man that's not
required. The Constitution gives every defendant, and if you know the Constitution, do you know the Constitution well, JC?
I do, and that's why Trump's going.
Is there any requirement that you have to testify in your own defense?
You don't have to, but if you're not guilty, you should.
Well, hold on. The minute you testify, you open yourself up to cross-examination. I can tell you from personal experience, most criminal defendants do not take the stand. They are not, and Trump considered it, but then he saw it was a rigged trial. But I want to go back to that question I asked you a moment ago. Can you tell me what he did that broke the law?
Yeah, obviously, I don't know all the details, but I do know that he slept with the porn star, and then
hold on. How do you know he slept with a porn star? Because she says it happened. She's also changed her story a number of times over the years. She's been trying to sell this story since, I think, 2006? Yeah, it was 2006, and there was actually one magazine that published it prior to 2016, but he says that he didn't. She says they did sleep together. And hold on, JC. JC, and by the way, sleeping with a porn star, as disgusting as that is not a crime. So I just want to ask you to step away from your partisanship and tell me this. If we just saw the first criminal prosecution of an American president in American history, and the average person can't tell you what he did that broke the law, does that concern you?
No, it doesn't, because that's what we have the justice system for.
Was justice delivered today when you can't even describe? Because, for example, you live in Pendleton. Let's say, are there any people in Pendleton that don't particularly like you?
I don't know what you mean.
Look, I can tell you there are a lot of people in the Northwest don't like me, but are there people in your town who don't like you?
I assume, yes, I guess.
You're not popular with everybody. So what if one day they say, you know what, that JC, he's a dirty dog. Let's prosecute him for something. And you say, well, what'd he do? You say, it doesn't matter. Let's just prosecute him. Let's throw him in jail. I don't like him. Now, are you concerned at all that a system that would say, we don't like Donald Trump, Joe Biden doesn't like him, Alvin Bragg doesn't like him, Judge Mershon clearly doesn't like him, we're going to find him guilty of something? And you say, how can you just prosecute somebody for something?
They would have to prove that, Lars.
Prove what? There were a murder case in Pendleton and there was a conviction, you'd say that man was guilty of murder. If it was a rape case, you'd say he's guilty of rape. If he was a thief, you'd say he was guilty of stealing things. when the average American can't even tell me what he's guilty of, what crime did he commit, does it concern you that this becomes like the old Soviet Union, where a guy by the name of Lavrenty Beria, who worked for Stalin, said, show me the man, I'll show you the crime, I'll find a crime to find him guilty of?
Lars, well, you know that he's pretty sneaky, right? He's one of those good New York rats. Them rats from New York, they're pretty sneaky. So his biggest mistake is he used campaign funds.
He didn't use campaign money. He used his own money. That was in the trial. He used his own money to pay personal debt, period. So you see, JC, I think you ought to think about the idea. Somebody in Pendleton says, hey, JC, I don't like that guy. Let's find a reason to throw him in jail. What reason? Ah, it doesn't matter. We don't need a reason. Just throw him in jail.
The Lars Larson